Distributing the Future broadcast July 10, 2006. Great location hacks.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. We're featuring three sessions from the second day of the Where 2.0 conference. Chris Spurgeon presents the best geo hacks of the last 2,000 years. Gary Lang looks at the possibilities that arise from APIs and open source code. And Tim O'Reilly moderates a panel on the future of the data industry. Years before Yahoo, MapQuest, or Google ever painted a map on a screen, we've been fascinated with hacking the world around us, using stars, the sun, planets. Well, Chris Spurgeon presented five of his favorite all-time hacks, including Galileo's clock in the sky, navigation Polynesian style, and his first hack, the calculation of the size of the Earth back in the times of the ancient Greeks.
If the first two questions people ever asked were, what can I eat and who can I have sex with? The third question was probably, you know, where the hell am I? Or, you know, where can I go to find food and sex? So there's been an amazing, amazing amount of innovation and just cleverness that's happened. First one I call the birth of geodesy. Geodesy is the science of measuring the Earth. This hack took place back in 240 BC, and the star of this hack is this guy, Eratosthenes. Eratosthenes was the librarian of the great library at Alexandria. He studied art, he studied literature, he studied medicine and music. He wrote a history of comedy. Anyway, one day, he heard a traveler in Egypt say, at noon on the day of the summer solstice in the city of Syene, which we now know as Aswan in Egypt, sunlight reaches the bottom of even the deepest wells. Now, that's just a little bit of traveler trivia, but to Eratosthenes, this opened the door to one of the great geo-hacks ever. He realized what this statement meant. The ancient Greeks knew the Earth was round. That whole thing with everyone thinking the Earth was flat until Columbus, total myth. So he knew the Earth was round. He realized that if sunlight was reaching the bottom of the well, that meant the sun must be directly overhead. He also realized that even on the first day of the solstice, a few hundred kilometers north in Alexandria where he is, that doesn't happen. Even at noon, the sun still makes a slight angle down in a well, or in his case, he actually used an obelisk and measured the angle of the shadow there. So he realized that if he could measure this angle in between these two towns and get the distance between those two points, he could figure out the size of the Earth. He figured the angle is about 1/50th part of a circle, about 7.12 degrees. He estimated the distance to be about 5,000 stadia. We don't know for sure, but we think a stadia is about 200 yards. This room from there to there is about a quarter of a stadia. So multiply those together, you get a circumference of the Earth about 250,000 stadia. In modern terms, that's about 46,000 kilometers. Now that is actually pretty damn good. That's about 15% off from the actual value. The important thing is that he did this measurement. You know, all of us, from the time we're born, we grow up with the knowledge of the Earth is round, the Earth is this size. You know, we're in school, we play with globes, we have geography lessons. We see things like this photograph from Apollo 17, this famous photograph. We all have this sense of the Earth, of its size, of its shape, of where we are on it. I think Eratosthenes, in the whole history of the Earth, and the billions of people that have come since, was the first person to actually know how big his home was. And I think it must have been an amazing feeling. Okay, that's hack number one. Here's hack number two. I call it the clock of the heavens. This one, we not only know the year it happened, we know the exact day. The day is January 7th, the year is 1610. On this day, this guy, Galileo, actually on the night of January 7th, this guy stepped out of his house in Pisa with his telescope and looked up at the night sky. He looked up at the planet Jupiter, what they still call the star Jupiter, and he saw these four little dots next to it. You can see Jupiter with the naked eye, but you could not see these tiny four dots without using a telescope. He, over subsequent nights and subsequent weeks, noticed that these dots moved in the sky. And it turns out they move in a very regular pattern. About 50 years later, Jean-Dominique Cassini, he put in a lot of great work mapping the movement of these little dots going around Jupiter, which Galileo realized were moons going around a separate planet. It's what got him in a lot of trouble with the Catholic Church down the road. But Cassini did a lot of amazing observation work, very detailed data collection. Okay, what does this have to do with mapping? Well, back in the, we're talking about in the 1600s, 1700s, around in there, we had already established this concept of latitude and longitude. We had that grid worked out, and we were using that as our basis for where you are on the Earth. Latitude is easy to determine, thanks to the stars and the sky. All the stars, you know, move in arcs around the sky, so do the planets, and it's a pretty straightforward measurement to see where they are and figure out your latitude, how far north or south you are. Longitude, much, much, much harder. And the way they came up with figuring out longitude was, in concept at least, if we could look and see where a star, let's say there's a star up there. If I can see where it is there, and I know precisely where someone at some other place on the Earth would see it at the exact same moment, I can figure out where I am in relation to them. That, in a nutshell, is what you need to do to figure out longitude. If you were to point a telescope at Jupiter at the moment I started talking, that's where you'd see the two innermost moons, Europa and Io. By the time I'm done talking, in about 15 minutes, those moons will have moved to here. And here, you can see that change if you look up at the screen. So these moons move with time, and they move in an amazingly predictable and precise way. So if you had a list of where those moons are going to be at different times, you can use this planet hundreds of millions of miles away as a giant clock hanging up in the sky. It's better than a clock. Never have to wind it, never slows down, never breaks, never runs out of electricity, nothing. It's a clock up in the sky. Brilliant, brilliant idea. Galileo thought of it first. Cassini did all the number crunching to make it possible. And then we had Reverend Neville Maskelyne. In 1766, he published this, the Nautical Almanac. This book contained table after table after table of where various stars and where the moons of Jupiter would be at various, you know, times. If you could see their position, you could look it up in this book and see what time it was back in Greenwich, England, and therefore figure out what time it must be where you are, and therefore figure out your longitude. This book, the Nautical Almanac, is the open API of the 18th century. This book made possible navigation. I mean, it's a little hard to hold a telescope at sea, but you can do it in port. It allowed us to survey, like, the American colonies, Canada, South America. It allowed us to map the world, all by using this clock up in the sky. Okay, that was hack number two. Here comes hack number three. Well, first of all, this happens back in 1933, and the star of this hack, not a male model, but a cartographer named Harry Beck. And Harry Beck drew this, the London Underground map. This is perhaps the only map of the whole 20th century that transcended being just a piece of cartography and became a groundbreaking piece of graphic design. Harry Beck was a freelance contract graphic designer for London Transport, the people that run the London Underground system. And he spent most of his time drawing electronic circuit diagrams, a very complex physical thing, and turned it into something like this, a very stylized, easy to understand diagram. Now, it's a diagram that doesn't have a lot of relation to reality, but the point is it simplifies to an extraordinary extent. So in 1933, Harry Beck aimed his intellect at the maps of the London Transport System. The map came out. It was a huge success. They would hand these out at tube stations, and they just, you know, a typical printing would last 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, something like that. They were gone in a week. So he did not rest on his laurels. He did a million different variations. He worked on maps, on various versions of this map for 27 years. The London Underground map has been constantly in beta since 1933. It's a real lesson. This map is not universally loved, by the way, by people in London, because you'll notice it doesn't show the city of London at all. The only thing that has any relation to London is the River Thames there. So it doesn't really tell you which station is, you know, closest to the Tower of London or anything like that. It doesn't tell you what station is closest near you. He threw all that out, sacrificing everything for this one goal of, once you're in the system, how do you get from one place, one station to another? Any cartographer knows that it's as important what you leave out of a map as what you put in. And he was a real, you know, he was really hardcore on that. Hack number four, how do you map something that has absolutely no features to hang, you know, to hang your map on? Nothing distinctive about one part from another, completely amorphous. This hack took place back in the 1940s, and what I'm talking about is this. How do you map the sky? You know, as aviation became very popular, particularly after World War II, this was a real problem. And the solution they came up with was something called VOR, and there are hundreds all around the country. There's one right over by at San Jose Airport at the end of one of the runways. If you're flying out of here, look for it. Each one of these spaces is a point that sends out a radio signal. And not just one radio signal, it sends out 360 radio signals, one for every degree of the compass. And with the proper instrumentation in an airplane, you can pick up one of these signals and it'll say, I'm coming from this tower on an angle of 34 degrees. And you know where you are on that line. Now, since there are multiple ones of these all over the country, all around the world, in effect, what we have done by using the VOR system is paint a huge highway system up in the sky that any aircraft can ride. And this explains why when you're flying cross country, suddenly, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere and the plane will just kind of turn a little bit and keep going. It's just turned from one highway, one freeway in the sky to another. So that's the fourth hack, the VOR system. The fifth one, we're going to go way back to talk about what I call the master navigators. This hack is ongoing. It started as early ago as 5,000 years ago, navigation in Polynesia. Polynesia is loosely defined by this triangle. That's Hawaii up in the north, New Zealand down in the southwest, Easter Island in the southeast. It's a big piece of water. For every acre of land in this triangle, there's about 500 acres of water. So how in the world can you get around in there, you know, safely and reliably over vast distances? Polynesian navigators learned the position of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of naked eye stars. You know, it's some serious learning, hundreds of stars, but you suddenly have a compass that's always with you. And this is for cultures that did not have the magnetic compass. Okay, so great. Now you've got direction. Let's talk a little bit about how they figured out latitude without sextants or any other instruments. As you change your latitude, the angle of these stars with the horizon changes. And Polynesian navigators knew this and memorized hundreds and hundreds of these little tweaks. So these are just a couple of the sky mapping techniques that the Polynesians had figured out. And I think it's just impressive as hell, because if mapping, you know, at its most basic is taking the physical world and turning it into a two-dimensional visual representation, then this ability to take a huge portion of the world that you've never seen above ground level or water level and project it onto this arbitrary collection of dots in the sky that is constantly moving with your position, with the seasons, with the time of day and time of night, to turn the world around you into a map above you, I think has to be one of the great intellectual achievements in all of history.
American Public Media's Chris Spurgeon with his best geohacks of the last 2,000 years. Although there have been maps well before this recent spate of online Ajaxian offerings, our relationship with maps has certainly changed. We expect that we can easily find directions to nearby stores or offices or homes within moments. There are big businesses in this geospatial space. Autodesk Gary Lang explains how open source has changed the business model and what his company has done about it. By the way, his microphone gives out in the middle and a new mic is found, so you're going to hear his voice change just a little bit. Here's Gary Lang.
But then came Google Maps, and suddenly our mothers and our fathers and our relatives are using geospatial software of a form, right? And I think what's happening is that and the release of Google Earth has brought the vision of what David Galanter used to call mirror worlds. Here's a quote from it that I think spells out what he was trying to say. Imagine looking at your computer screen and seeing reality, an image of your city, for instance, complete with moving traffic patterns or a picture that sketches the state of an entire corporation at this second. This will soon be available to everyone. He was spot on. This is actually happening now. If you look at Google Earth, because they're not Keyhole, they're a big advertising provider, they're now charged with and are giving us access to information about the entire planet. It's totally plausible to think of different kinds of communication happening using a model of the Earth. And that's what David Galanter talks about in this book. So I encourage everybody to read it. It's really fascinating. In essence, what's happened in this genre, in the web mapping genre, is that people are combining a hatred of Microsoft with a love of Google Labs with an interest, and that creates an interest in developing stuff on top of Google Maps. Lots of stuff happened with the Google APIs, as you know, and mashups. People have been talking about it. There's been open source geospatial software for a long time. It's actually one of the most long-lived genres of open source software. You have GRASS and a number of other packages. I've used them for over 15 years myself. But now, because of Google Maps and the explosion of interest in geospatial software, that's the level of interest you see. So the standards facilitated growth, you have the open web servers, web services that we talk about here, and here are the packages from the Open Source Geospatial Foundation that support them. And then there's a simple feature spec for SQL that's out now and supported by at least two databases. We think both of them are really great products. So let me tell you about Autodesk going open source, why we did it, and what the process was like. Basically, we're too slow. We have a very typical development cycle within Autodesk. It's about a year and a half on average for new products. For standing products, we're able to do it in a year, but with a reduced feature set. So most of our desktop products now are shipped in a year's time frame. But if you're doing a new product, it basically takes a year and a half. So I'll give you an example. A customer's asked us for WMS support, and we thought about it, and our product management people went off and thought about it and said, it's not necessary right now, so it missed getting into the requirements document and missed getting into our waterfall, right? And then about 6 months later, the hue and cry got much larger, and we said, okay, we'll put it into the next version. So, great, it goes into the next requirements document, and from there we start the next development cycle and finally it'll come out. WMS is not that hard, right? What we probably should do is just have allow somebody to develop it and add it to our product. And if it's good enough for them, it sort of works, and somebody else can take it and enhance it and add more features, et cetera. It's a better business, it's a better development model for that kind of software. That's what we've determined. And so, as I talked about before, since MapGuide itself is a commodity, how are we going to make money on it? If you look at a revenue stack for software developed on MapGuide, MapGuide itself comprised only 9 or 10% of the total revenue. The rest of the money is made by folks like people in this room, doing consulting work or developing their own applications on top of it. So when we looked at that pie, we thought, why are we so focused on this one little sliver of where the money is? So it just made business sense for us.
For our other products, we're a second or third tier player compared to ESRI and Intergraph. And so if we're able to create a solution set in which we have a compelling open source offering, which is actually a requirement that comes up more and more from people for web mapping in particular, largely due to Map Server and to the general simplicity of the genre, it just makes sense for us to make that part of our solution. We're going to sell more Map, is the way we think about it. And finally, we have an application on top of Map and MapGuide, as I talked about, and it makes business sense for that as well, because, again, tiny sliver MapGuide, big sliver application. Topabase is an application that we sell. So it drives closed source genres into open source. When you're able to switch from an existing closed source product to an open source product because the API is the same, it creates a forum for commoditization. And then, of course, we have all these standard APIs that we're falling against now, and open source geospatial will become more ubiquitous. I believe there will be open source versions of Google Maps widely available and useful within a matter of months.
Gary Lang on APIs and open source code. Finally, we feature an unedited excerpt from a panel discussion that Tim O'Reilly led on the future of the data industry. Data is key to geospatial applications, but do you need to spend $35 million a year to collect that information?
Many years ago, I started noticing that software was becoming much more data intensive. In fact, I tried and failed to coin a new word back in 1997, infoware, to try to describe this conjunction of applications that only work when there's a big database behind them. And so just thinking a lot about the role of data in the world of future applications led eventually to our thinking about Web 2.0 and ultimately Ware 2.0. And in that thinking, one of the areas that I focused on was that there's really two ways that data becomes valuable. And one is that we have these enormous network effects in the creation of user-generated content on the internet. We also have cases, and I think one of our panelists, TeleAtlas, represents that, where you build a database through a lot of hard work, or Globe Explorer. I haven't launched any communication satellites lately, and I don't know that any of you have either. Not communication satellites, but photography satellites. So there's this question of how do we get the data, and where is the value chain allocation between data and software? And those are some of the ideas that we want to explore here. And so I have, from right to left, Rob Shanks, who is the founder of Globe Explorer, which is one of the leading providers of digital satellite imagery, so that when you go out there and see these cool images, somebody made those, right? And Steve's one of the pioneers in that. Steve Coast, on the other hand, has been saying, hey, we can, in fact, create valuable databases through user-generated activity. And we heard about OpenStreetMap.com and the like, and so forth. Kim Fennell of Telcantar, or actually, and Carta now.
Descartes
is the Microsoft Encyclopedia.
Those other guys.
Yeah. So represents sort of the software platform play, and David Nevin from TeleAtlas is really one of the premier sources of the data that Kim uses in his application to drive routing and street maps and the like. So maybe each of you guys could just give a real brief introduction of what you do, but I really like to focus a little bit on how the whole value chain hangs together in these applications. So I don't know,
go first.
Okay. Or
did you want me to go first?
Maybe Kim should go first because he has a picture that he showed me earlier, and we asked if we could just put it up on the screen.
Sure. So good afternoon, everybody. The idea here, Tim and I chatted about maybe just with one slide, we could kind of talk a little bit about the overall value chain. And this is just purely from the software side. Obviously, there's chipsets that go in handsets and whatnot that are not represented there. But if you look at the overall ecosystem of location-based services, internet mapping, et cetera, you really have the four components plus the end user that you see on the screen there. You need to start with data. And whether that is map and street information that folks like TeleAtlas provide, rich content in that regard, or whether it's user-generated content that Steve's company is doing. You've got aerial and satellite imagery, which Globe Explorer is doing. Then you've got points of interest, whether it's, give me all the list of Italian restaurants that we can then later put on a map. You got traffic information, real-time traffic information, predictive, et cetera. And then you got dynamic data, whether that is, open tables, reservations, or show me the cheapest gas that's out there right now. So a lot of different types of content coming in, and that's getting even more complex day to day. Next in the chain is a geospatial software platform. That's where we fit in as what was Telcantar. This is a cheap way to describe our new company name called Descartes. But anyway, what we do is we process that data. And we reformat it, put it into a unique data format to optimize it for high-volume retrieval. And so it's a geospatial engine that you'll find underneath Google Maps and local search, underneath Yahoo Maps and local search, Ask, plus a lot of the wireless applications you're seeing today launched by Verizon, Sprint, Nextel for, say, turn-by-turn navigation. And so as a platform, we just process that data very, very quickly in a unique way. And then application developers are next in the value chain. They tend to build their apps on top of a platform, and you see a lot of combinations there on the chart, whether it's internet maps, local search, whether it's a navigation application on a cell phone, fleet management applications for enterprise purposes, social networking apps, location games was already described. So those folks build on top of that engine. And then obviously you need a service provider to take it to market, and whether that's an internet portal, who is also an app developer, or whether it's someone like a Verizon, who is just the service provider and are buying apps from a whole host of application developers that are out there. So that's kind of the value chain overall. And again, where we fit in is we're purely a geospatial engine. Our customers like Google, Yahoo, et cetera, use us, A, for technology reasons, for routing. So if you're getting driving directions today, when you put in your origin and your destination, hit enter, it's our routing algorithms of figuring out how to get you there using, say, TeleAtlas data to get you there legally, accurately. We won't ask you to turn left on a road that won't let you turn left. And and also, finally, just non-branded. So people design the map, and all the creativity to the maps is that of our customers. And they take it
from that. There are, though, in addition to, you guys are in this sort of stack frame, so to speak, but both MapQuest and Microsoft try to sort of do a bunch of those layers themselves. That
exactly. They are a service provider, but they also have their own technology driving.
Right. Okay. So how about we start at your end?
I'll start it.
Rob, yeah.
At Globe Explorer, we're really a kind of a global aggregator of aerial and satellite imagery. We produce a lot of our own content ourselves, so we fly and process and produce both digital and analog to digital formats of satellite and aerial imagery, and also about 30 other map layers of information, such as parcel ownership boundaries, particularly in North America. We really view the data community right now as sort of following suit with the open source community, where you have a lot of very large volumes of free or publicly available data, and these may be subsidized by the U.S. government, by NASA, by local, federal, and state agencies, and all of that is being aggregated and produced at very popular consumer websites. But at Globe Explorer, we see ourselves more as the Red Hat of the data industry, because we add higher value content than what is publicly available traditionally. It's newer, it's higher resolution, it's different, and it ties together both database and attribute information with an image location, so you can click on it and see property values and things of that nature.
So you guys actually provide the data to Zillow, right?
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. So you'll see some of the overlays featured at a site like that, and we build at Globe Explorer. The technology that we build, we actually make freely available as an open source model, and we plug into platforms like Telcantar's platform. And so, yeah, our content is warehoused in a very high volume, highly scalable image and map server environment. We have our own platform, but our goal is to plug our platform directly into other platforms like Telcantar, so that if you are programming in Google Maps, or if you are programming using Ask or any other API or platform, you can access our content at very high speeds on the fly. And we are truly integrated at sort of the source level, so we can hand customers just JavaScript or HTML that connect our web services to other web mapping platforms and quickly produce a very valuable end-user product and experience.
Okay. So, David, do you want to, since you're also sort of down there at the, holding everybody else up, tell us about your data.
Or sitting at the bottom.
Yeah, sitting at the bottom of the pyramid with everybody else sitting on your shoulders.
So, yes, thank you, everyone. I'm David Nevin. I'll be the token digital map vendor here on the panel today. So use the same diagram that Kim articulated, so we focus down the left-hand side. We produce the road and map data. We partner with GlobeX and actually use a tremendous amount of their data internally, right, to both correct the vector map data as well as to ensure that they're in perfect alignment. We get points of interest, both some that we build for landmarks ourselves as well as we partner with other companies such as InfoUSA, to deliver over 11 million points of interest across the U.S. and 25 million globally. Traffic content, so we recently announced a new partnership with a company called INRIX that's going to talk later, that we see one of the core values is taking dynamic information and aligning that correctly with the maps so that you can offer higher level features such as the current traffic information or future traffic information to give you a better, more accurate real drive time and produce more useful applications out of that.
So it sounds like in some ways you're aggregating data from a lot of sources as well. You know, that we're never going to get down to the original, who generates the data in the first place.
Well, we actually do a lot of that in the first bucket only, right? The map and road data. So we have over 50 drivers across the U.S. and a couple hundred across Europe, right, that are out there driving the roads every day. We also have found that that's a fairly expensive process. So we've also built partnerships with over 50,000 government entities across the U.S. alone, and we get automated data or in whatever data formats they can provide it to us. So we have partnerships with these organizations that send us the data. We will update it, use it internally, and in most cases feed it back to them to build their state's data sets.
Can you give me kind of an idea of the order of magnitude cost to generate the data that you have generated?
Sure. In the U.S. alone, it's probably roughly a $35 million investment year over year. On a global basis, about $150 million. We have data in over 50 countries across the globe.
Okay. So when you say year over year, you mean each year?
Each year, per year investment.
So in other words, it's non-trivial. So Steve, what do you say to that?
Let's say it is trivial. I should apologize. My voice is slightly gone. It's interesting to think about the value, specifically with OpenStreetMap, where we derive our value, because we almost derive that. Thank you. We derive that value from information that is otherwise thrown away. So you just leave a GPS in your car, and you don't really care that the GPS is there. We don't employ people. We don't have 50 cars and so on. And that data that would otherwise be thrown away, we can aggregate and use. And also, it doesn't really matter much to you what the name of your street is, but it might matter to me and if I don't live on that street and so on. So we can aggregate stuff that you would otherwise just throw away. And I think it is trivial what we're doing, and it will just be a matter of time.
So could you see yourself, you guys working together? I mean, do you see OpenStreetMap and TeleAtlas one day partnering, or?
Categorically. I mean, we are actually, we have to be an enabler to this marketplace, to all kinds of applications and other types of content. TeleAtlas actually, our founders came out of the Census Bureau back in the 1960s, right? So they're born out of a lot of either open source or other government projects in order to find ways to collect and build more data. So anybody here that has either interest in collection technology, has unique content, we're very interested in talking to you about how we can potentially be a distribution channel for you, but certainly invest in helping you to build the data sets, to find new partnerships, to potentially participate in developer programs that we have, but just basically add more value by bringing together both public, private, open source partnerships to be able to build a larger ecosystem of data that's used globally and is used for more and intriguing purposes.
So could I ask a question just in general, like when we think about
Steve might have a different perspective.
Oh, sorry.
No, I very much like to. I mean, OpenStreetMap is very much constrained by this barrier of people having to have GPS units. So if we can go out and we can combine your aerial imagery, if we can combine the kind of process to fill in the last 20 or 10% or whatever of all the little nooks and crannies that otherwise wouldn't get mapped, then you have something quite powerful that would either be a competitor to the traditional data industry in GIS or something that will just take it forward.
Thanks to Tim O'Reilly, Steve Coast, Kim Fennell, David Nevin, Rob Shanks, Gary Lang, and Chris Spurgeon. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@oreilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.